the end of this text, the Metta Sutta, has this this particular thrill to me. Not just because I love the content, but because the trajectory of the teaching, it's been cruising along in a more or less predictable way. You know, it says basically, you know, purify your heart, act well, be good, do good things, love everybody, really love everybody. Like, that's the trajectory. And then, in this last sentence, the text just takes a sharp left turn, and it says, oh, by the way, and then it dumps one of the most profound wisdom teachings of the whole tradition. And it's this amazing, like, you know, like, you thought you were just, like, kind of learning to love everybody, and suddenly, like, boom, liberation through not clinging to fixed views. And often when students first encounter this part of the text, they're like, what? Like, how did we get here? And so again, here's the progression, right? This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward, gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented, easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, frugal in their ways. This is an invocation of the basic renunciation that is the ground of the path. At the beginning of the text says, the start of clarity, the beginning of wisdom, is to let go, is to not cling, and to cultivate these qualities of humility, gentleness, kindness of heart. And the list, you know, grows through peaceful, calm, wise, skillful, humble. And then the beautiful and sharp ethical turn, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. So there's this profound, like, building up from the bottom up, this basic wholesome ego structure of these good qualities, kind of universal good qualities. We can think of them as universal good qualities. According to the text, they are. And then the relational holding of the ethical peace, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. And it begins this orientation toward kindness, the wish for all beings to be safe. All beings everywhere is the direction or the tone of the text, and so then whatever living beings there may be, weak or strong, omitting none, those living near and far away, the great, the mighty, the medium, the short, the small, seen and unseen, born and to be born. So near and far away means throughout all of space. Born and to be born means past and future. All beings in all times and spaces, may they be at ease. Even the ones that you feel judgment or hatred toward, let none despise another, deceive another, despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. This, of course, is not easy, and it's a long practice to not despise. We talked a few weeks ago about hatred and the feeling of hatred in the heart and what happens when fear and the sense of threat calcify or harden into hatred against another. And then the beautiful metaphor of maternal love that grounds the text, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world in all directions. And we talked about these qualities of protect and cherish. A mother protects her child. One should cherish all living beings. And again, so far, the whole text feels like it's kind of opening outward into this fuller and fuller sense of kindness and friendliness and love. And then we get the meditation practice itself, radiating kindness over the entire world, upwards to the skies, downwards to the depths, outwards unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. And then to maintain that practice all the time, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down. These are the four postures in the early Buddhist system. And when you think of them as kind of generalization for all the whole of your life, you're always either sitting, standing, walking, or lying down in some variation. Free from drowsiness. I like this is the one hindrance it mentions. Oh. Right. And this is important because in a way, drowsiness is the one of the hindrances that makes concentration and mindfulness, which have to be there for this kindness to be radiated, basically impossible. Like, you can't, and we might even think of them in relation to this friendliness. It's very hard to be friendly when you are half asleep. And it's curious that that's the one that's there. It doesn't say free from restlessness or free from doubt, free from, you know, grasping or aversion. We kind of got that earlier. But here, the poetry of the text is, through the four postures, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. And so the sustain is the concentration practice, right? Keep it going, don't let it waver. And then recollection is the recollection, the holding in the mind of the sense of all beings being cared for. So one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. Abiding is a translation of the word viharati and or vihara, which means both. A vihara is a little hut that wandering pilgrims stay in when they're on pilgrimage. And so the word, interestingly, means both to rest somewhere and to wander around. It has this kind of double meaning, and that's very interesting, right? That an abiding, a place where you rest, is both the place where you pause on the journey and it's the journey itself. And it's the same word in Pali for both. And then abiding, and especially divine abiding, is also the word used for these meditative states. So, like if you're doing breath practice and you rest into a deep breath concentration and everything becomes still and warm and vibrate-y, and you stay there for a while, that's considered an abiding. And the various abidings have names. You know, there's a state in the texts called the beautiful. And it's a meditative state that you can land in. Yeah? And it where beautifulness is the core quality, the perception of beautifulness. There's a state that's called infinite space, where the perception of infinite space is the quality. There's a state called nothing, where the perception of nothing is the quality, etc. And so abiding refers to these specific concentration states. And so for metta, those states are the states, and they're also considered heaven realms. So you could die and be reborn in this realm and live there for some time. And you could take that as literal or a metaphor. The divine abidings, or Brahma Vihara, are metta, the focus of this text, loving kindness or friendliness, and then compassion, which is what happens when kindness meets suffering, and then appreciation, which is what happens when kindness meets good fortune. Appreciation, I like to say sometimes celebration even. And then equanimity, which is what happens when kindness understands that both suffering and joy are part of life but impermanent and fluctuate all the time. And begins to rest in a deep ease that doesn't cling to the pleasant or resist the unpleasant. Equanimity is one of the divine abidings. So here, sustain the recollection, may all beings be at ease, is the sublime abiding. One of the beautiful resting places for the heart-mind. And so then all the practices surrounding this quality of loving-kindness are both heart-opening practices and concentration practices, as we talked about 2 weeks ago. And the concentration is the meditative quality of stabilizing the attention with this quality and fixing it there. And you can enter what are known as the absorptions, or jhana, the deep samadhi, integrated mind states based in these qualities. And it's one of the both easiest and most popular ways to do so, at least in the Western tradition, to use the heart practices like metta as a pathway into deep meditative stabilization. And then there's this amazing last sentence that we've got to. So you've been brought into this, not just the loving of everyone, but the stabilization of the mind in this quality of kindness. Samadhi in the Buddhist tradition is considered to be one of the most powerful foundations for liberating insight, because in that profound steadiness of mind, energy arises, clear seeing gets very focused and bright, and time slows down a little bit when we're that concentrated, so we can actually begin to perceive the micro fluctuations of mind states. And it's in the perceiving of these little fluctuations in the mind that we start to see clearly, that we start to see that every mind state is temporary, that when we're happy based in conditions, and that it slips away as soon as we want more of it. But also that when there's pain or distress, we're in distress because of conditions, and it's already changing, even as we're cringing and resisting and trying to solve it or push it away. It's moving, and again, like slipping through our grasp. And it's only really with the mind that gets some concentration, some steadiness to it, that we can actually see not just our big moods fluctuating and changing like tides, but all the little tiny waves, the micro reactions. Somebody says something, it's a flicker of fear, and then it's gone. And we don't even notice it. As we begin to notice it, we'll start to see how our experience is composed of this constant, like, strobe light of different states flickering on and off, things appearing and disappearing faster than thought. And that this is the experience of existing. So the last sentence, this left turn toward the wisdom teachings, it says, by not holding to fixed views, how did we get here? We've come through, like, get purify, act clearly, love everyone, really love everyone, stabilize the mind, and then by not holding to fixed views. And you might feel into or think for a moment about, like, oh, what would it be about this practice of love everyone that would lead to not holding on to fixed views? Why are those things connected? They're clearly sequential in the text. Love everyone. Stabilize the mind. Don't hold on to fixed views. What do you think? Any sort of intuitive hit of, like, what's the connection there? Yeah.
Well, if you love everyone, that also implies love every moment and every single change you just mentioned, like the little waves.
Yeah.
And if I put the kindness towards every single moment or something, then I'll not have the time to reflect, oh, do I really love this guy? Or I don't know. It's like,
right.
Then I don't hold on to a fixed view because it changes,
I think. Yeah, right. So you're pointing to this, the relationship between seeing impermanence, and if you really see impermanence, you can't hold on to any bit of it, which would be a fixed view, a fixed experience you can't hold on to. And then this interesting piece, this is a link that's often made, where in order to really love something, you have to see it or contact it in some way. You have to, you know, not exclude it from your heart. And so there's this way that metta, or loving kindness, loving things, becomes kind of synonymous with mindfulness, being aware of them. Right? If I'm concentrated and experiences are flickering through consciousness, there can be this kind of pure seeing of them and a kind of a kind seeing of them. And it turns out that they're kind of the same thing, right? If you're seeing something without judging it, there's a kind of baseline presence that's intimate and clean in some way. And that's one of the ways we might talk about this quality, that we have been talking about this quality of loving kindness or friendliness. Maybe it just means, like, let your mindfulness be warm or not dry, like sweet in a certain way. What else do you think?
Well, you couldn't do that with fixed views.
And you can't do that with a fixed view.
You have to be open to.
Right. So if I have a fixed view, I also can't do the practice we talked about earlier of not despising any being. If I have any fixed view, there's going to be an opposing view out there. And so, if I want to love everything, I also can't... if I want to love everything equally, I can't love my view over another's view.
Right, you can't judge.
Right. So then, they have to come together. This is part of the implication, is that you can't actually love everything in a vast way without the wisdom that sees everything equally. Right? Is already let go. And the text starts with letting go, right? It starts with the basic renunciate practices. Other thoughts here, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when you say fixed view, is it something that is subconsciously a view? I guess we have a lot of, mm-hmm. like, you know, socially... how do you express that? That we're socialized and we are... There are norms that are kind of that we act after,
mm-hmm.
but in a way they become fixed because we just do it.
Yeah.
But we are not necessarily aware of them always.
Yeah, absolutely. I think most of our views are unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, tip of the iceberg, there's the views that I'm aware of, right? Mm-hmm. I like
mm-hmm.
gelato, mm-hmm. and I don't really like something else, whatever, right? Anything that's not gelato, you know, like, and then there's like deep views that are like, you know, that we can think of as like systemic ideologies, right? Like, you know, oh, I'm a unique individual, or all people are worthwhile, or, you know, mean people aren't so worthwhile, or like whatever I've grown been subjected to. And of course this includes like the deep ones like racism and classism and ableism and all of the systems that we have to believe in order to perpetuate, mm-hmm. right, our fixed views.
I can give an example.
Yeah.
I'm from Denmark, and in Denmark we have a very homogeneous society, and we often speak of ethnic things and non-ethnic things.
Uh-huh.
And it has become, like, since I moved here, I've realized how, like, speaking of ethnic something,
yes,
is just not something you do because many people are migrants. And I mean, even though I know that it's somehow like a racist expression, it's so inherent in Danish culture because we're so homogeneous that we're speaking of ethnic and non-ethnic.
Right. There's us and there's everything else.
Yeah. And so for me to come here, like that kind of view that I use that verbally when I'm in Denmark and it's kind of socially accepted.
Yeah.
Became very clear that I don't want to do that again.
It's great. And so you can see that this points to something really subtle, which is that a fixed view is more than just a view. It's actually like It's embedded in everything, like culture and language and family. You know, it's just a word. But the word is, we would say, like, one of the psychological terms would be like cathected, sorry. It's like deeply embedded in culture and then in thought patterns and, you know, outward from there. So not holding to fixed views is going to become a practice then of gradually seeing, especially the harmful ones, like what you're talking about. You see this thing, say, oh, this is actually harmful. I want to change that pattern in myself, and that becomes a practice. By not holding to fixed views, this is going to go far in practice because you start off with this kind of thing, like, oh, this is sort of a purification practice. May I work with this view that I can see in myself that is harmful? But then, you know, once you get into not holding to fixed views, it starts to trickle down into everything. And at the deeper, trippy ends of practice, where you're resting in these profound states of universal kindness, one of the fixed views that starts to slip away is the sense of being a self that's somehow separate from others, that's somehow different from others. And this is edgy to talk about in a certain way because it's a developmental stage that's not appropriate. It's not an appropriate recollection for every developmental stage. So like my toddler right now is busily engaged in creating an ego self. And every day he's figuring out new ways to differentiate himself from us parents. And so, I was making a salad dressing earlier today, and I was done with the miso, and I went to put it back in the refrigerator, and he said, no. I was like, what? And he said, no, Papa, take miso too fast. And I was like, oh, do you want to put the miso in the fridge? You know, Rivi put it. And I'm like, oh, you had to just resist me right there on the, like, putting the miso in the fridge too fast. Not because it's all about the miso, but because we're doing this thing right now where, like, you have an impulse and you've learned how to say what it is and ask for it, and then I get to respond, and then you get to figure out where the edge is, you know. Our current edge is he picks up one of the little wooden trains, looks at me, throws it. I say, no throwing hard things, we throw balls and soft things. He picks up the second train, looks at me, pauses. And I say, don't throw the train. He throws the train, right? And I say, if you throw the trains, we stop playing with them. You know that's the game. He picks up the train and looks at me. So this is the story right now. And you know, other than not liking getting hit in the head with flying trains, the whole thing is kind of delightful to me. I'm like, oh, this is great, because we're really going to figure out that you are a self. And I'm not going to tell him that there's a teaching that he's not really a self for 20 years yet and change. Because it's not developmentally appropriate, and it's not appropriate in many different ways. You know, there's whole aspects of creating safety in cultures, for instance. This is the identity politics thing, where it's actually completely appropriate and necessary to solidify an identity, particularly in relation to oppression. So, folks who are members or who hold a quality that's part of an oppressed group, it's important actually to hold on to a certain fixed view. Because solidarity is one of the only ways that social change happens. So, for instance, you know, in over the last kind of 40 years, the unfolding of, let's say, what we might now call queer liberation, but maybe used to call gay rights, In the first few decades of it, there was this sense that it was important to delineate kind of who was gay and who was not, and that was a a strict or solid or black and white kind of thing. And there were different movements that came out. And not everyone was saying this, but there were some strong pushes. For instance, there was a whole period there of like trying to look for the gene or the genetics or the brain function that made some folks gay and some folks not. And then there was a whole push that had to be a push for like, we're born like this, because that had to be asserted as a resistance to an oppressive ideology that it was just a lifestyle choice, right? So all of these ways that in the pursuit of equal treatment and justice and not being harmed, a kind of fixed view had to be held onto in order to shift the culture. And as the culture shifted, not everywhere, but in some places toward more and more acceptance and less oppression of certain kinds, the doctrines shifted into like whole gray areas started to appear, and ideas that it wasn't actually biologically fixed necessarily, but also that it wasn't necessarily a choice, but that there could be aspects of it that could come and go, or that could be a choice, or that could be not about being a choice or not, but it's just a whole web of different ways of being queer. And generation after generation, different attitudes toward this. Till now, when I teach teen meditation classes, one of the first things we do is everyone says their name and their gender pronouns, which grew out of gay rights, which grew into trans rights, and then gender fluidity. And now it's completely common for high schoolers in my classes to say, you know, hi, my name is such and such, I'm non-binary, and I go by they, them, or X. And we're like, and all the other kids in the class, granted this is the Bay Area, are like, cool, right? And I'm like, how did that happen? There's this massive gray area where people can define themselves however they want within certain, you know, social parameters. The view gets to become less fixed as oppression patterns are dealt with slowly. So this teaching, by not holding to fixed views, is developmentally appropriate when all of these preceding conditions have been met, right? So the heart has been clarified through renunciation, through wise action, through ethical action, which means a functional community of non-harming, non-despising, non-hatred. It feels like the text is really talking about individual practice, but, you know, let none deceive another. That's a pretty broad, non-hating kind of culture, if we could build that in. And I think only based in that can you get to this turning here now by not holding to fixed views. Once that non-despising and universal love and clear seeing and a kind of friendly mindfulness or intimacy with things has been established, oh, then there's a kind of safety, a profound safety, and then I can let go further. And so this is now the letting go that turns toward liberation. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, so the one who's no longer in the act of purifying, but actually gets to rest in some degree of the heart being pure, not liking nor disliking as much, not fixed into who I am and who they are. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, right? The vision not being clouded by fear, by anxiety, by hatred, by ideology, by fixed view. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed, past tense, this is really like, this is the one who's on the brink of liberation, being freed from all sense desires. So the corollary to not hating is also not grasping. And so being freed from all sense desires, I think that doesn't mean that they don't ever appear. I think sense desires is part of having a body, as far as we can tell. They keep happening. But freedom from them, I think, in a most practical way means not being governed by them. When I was a teenager, I was mad for ice cream. And I ate ice cream a lot, really a lot. And I very often would just spend all my lunch money on just ice cream sandwiches. And coming home from school, I would have a shake. And the day that I noticed it was a normal school day somewhere in my junior year of high school, where I noticed that I'd had a little ice cream after breakfast. I had had ice cream sandwiches for lunch. I had had a shake after school when I came home and I was watching Japanese cartoons. And then I had some ice cream after dinner. And then it was 11:30 at night and I was watching Doctor Who on the BBC public television channel. It was the old Doctor Who. And I was having my fifth bowl of ice cream of the day. This is how you got so fat. This is how I got, check it out, you know? This is how I got so fat. And only then did I notice it. And my mind had the startlingly innocent thought, maybe 5 servings of ice cream is a little too much in a day. Just maybe. You know, but from that day, I never did that again. I kind of just stopped. And I stopped more or less cold turkey for a while, and then eventually, it trickled in again. It took 10 years from that point for good stuff like Ben and Jerry's to appear. That was back where it was still just Dreyer's mint chip, which is not bad, but... we hadn't gotten onto Three Twins yet. So that was, I never again was had to have it. I still totally love it. And every once in a while it appears and I have a little bit and my whole being goes whoa, ice cream. Ice cream is so good. And sometimes, I'll be in the store and the sense desire will pass through me like a little icy sweet wind from the past. I'll just sort of walk by the aisle. I'll be double rainbow. And then, but rarely do I actually feel the need to buy it. And it's sort of like the sense desire is there, but I feel freed from it. If I never had it again, I would... think about it just a tiny bit. But it wouldn't haunt my heart in the way that that it did when I was unconscious to it. So being freed from all... what if it was like that for every physical thing we want? And again, this is not a teaching for every stage of the path. This is a teaching for the liberation turn at the end. There's whole stages where indulging in the pleasures, the wholesome pleasures of existence are... healing and stabilizing and grounding and part of the beautiful states in life. But this is the turn toward vastness. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, and here's liberation, is not born again into this world. This speaks to one of the earliest visions of what liberation could be, which is that it's the end of the compulsion toward continued existence. And not born again into this world, you can think of it again, you can think of it literally, doesn't get reborn after you die out of this body. That would be a very traditional way to think about it in terms of rebirth. But even in the earliest layer of the texts, born again is spoken of both literally and metaphorically. And the term that gets translated as born again, it can also be translated as like makes a home in. And we come back to this resting place idea, the vihara, the resting place, to be born in relation to like an ever turning cycle of experience is talked about even in a moment-to-moment way, where when conditions assemble to give rise to a certain state, and then there's an identifying with that state, and again, that's a fixed view, I am this thing. There's a birth as that thing. And whenever there's a birth, there will be a death. And so then there's the fear of loss of that. Sometimes it happens that I come here after a busy day or whatever my state is, and I come here and I come and sit down and I start the meditation and I haven't really remembered that I'm sometimes a teacher. And I'm kind of just sitting here and I kind of give the initial meditation instructions a little bit by rote. Sorry. But you know, they're kind of the same every time. And then I just sit. And in the course of sitting, sometimes it's just like me sitting, like I would sit at home or I've sat on endless retreats and all that. And sometimes it's not until like the announcements and the social peer, like, I see you and I'm like, oh, look, I'm here with these people. And I like these people. They come a lot and we talk. And then I start to talk about the teachings and something assembles in me. And some weeks it does and some weeks it doesn't. But some weeks the thing that assembles is the perception called teacher. Not just the activity, teaching, which is a joyful activity for me, but sometimes that becomes, and that would be taking birth as, the perception teacher. And it comes with a kind of I am. And it's, and you know, like you were saying, it's subconscious mostly. You know, and in a way it's necessary, like you inhabit your role, whatever that is, professionally or relationally. But to take birth as that thing is to go this extra little step into, it's almost like believing it, landing in it and being like, I am that thing. And as soon as that happens, you can be said to have taken birth as that thing. I take birth as the teacher. I'm born. And of course, if you're born, then you suffer and you're going to die. Because that's the thing about birth in this tradition. Very straightforward. You know, the main cause of death is birth. So then, is not borning into this world points to maybe the end of physical literal rebirth. Certainly that, if you hold that aspect of the structure, but. What if it also means, and there is the implication that it means, the end of this kind of moment-to-moment fixated self-rebirth? What if you don't become the teacher, the student, the brother, the sister, the partner, the professional, the anxious one, the worried one, the successful one, the ambitious one? All of these little pinpoints of light that we call like our identity, these little definitions of yourself. What if each one of those was loved, was seen, was held in the web of all things, and as such, no longer was individual to you? What if each one of those things ceased to be a fixed view? What would that be like? It's not like you're going to suddenly die. So then here you are alive, having let go of every fixed view of who you might be. And what would that experience be like? And so then this invitation, this is how the text closes. You want a kind of a big bell at the end of it, you know, is not born again into this world. If you chant this at home, I'll suggest like chant it to the end and then just really stop. Just let the mind open and steady. This is an invitation to this path, not just as a reducer of stress or an opener of the heart in this life, but actually the path that goes through the cultivation of kindness and love for everybody as the doorway to the end. got to the end of the text. It took us 2 full months. So all the talks are on the website. Listen to them if you missed any. Any thoughts or reflections at this point? Oh, no worries.
I have a question.
Please.
I think a few minutes ago you said something about home and vihara.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand how you were relating that to what you were explaining about birth and identity. Did that connect with that at all?
It did in my mind. The connection was something like, what if taking birth moment to moment, kind of as different phenomena arise and we identify with them, what if that's like stopping in a vihara on your pilgrimage? Mm-hmm. So you're in this endless journey and then you pause in a place and you have a resting spot there for a while. And like, you know, I had a resting point for a while as like the classical violinist. And then that guy died. And I had a different vihara, took birth as the experimental composer. And then that guy, I don't know, got lost somewhere. And what emerged was like, you know, the postmodern dancer, and then the performance artist, and then the one who's given up the arts, and then the monk. And each of those kind of like somebody died and someone was reborn. And so in the journey of my life, it was like those were these kind of identifiable little resting places, different viharas to stop in. What if all of our identities are just little kind of cabins at the side of the trail, but inevitably you leave them and you keep hiking? That was the...
You used the word abide in that connection.
Yeah.
I always loved that word. Would you tell again? That was a translation of...
Yeah. Abiding is the translation of vihara. And it means, and the word vihara, strangely, simultaneously means both a resting place on your pilgrimage and the wandering itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is interesting. There's some way then it almost implies to me that like wandering and pausing in the wandering are the same thing. Like, that is the journey. It's not an endless run around. It's not a hamster wheel. It's actually a wander and a resting point. And a wander and a resting point. And if we think about this from the nervous system direction that we've talked about sometimes, this is a very natural cycle. That there's a cycle of activation and deactivation and pause. You know,
Rest is part of the wander.
Rest is part of the wander. You go out looking for something, you get it, you land. And then you go out looking for something else, and you land. You know, and then we can think of our life, or our many lives if we want to, as this kind of series of, you know, an impulse takes us out of the state of rest, and then it either succeeds or fails, but that at some point its karma lands, and then there's a kind of pause. And the longer samadhis, the deep meditative states, are a way of saying, pause for longer. Like, actually hit this moment of deep nervous system pause and just don't move for like a couple hours, a couple days, just like stretch it out. Like you're hovering in this state of when one thought ends before another one begins, you just hover there for a few days. I've talked with practitioner friends who are like, yeah, it occurred to me at some point that I hadn't had a single thought in 3 or 4 days. That I might be more concentrated than I thought. Right?
No way.
No way. Yeah, seriously. Seriously. So there are those states, and those are vihara also. Those are abidings, places you abide. Yes, please.
But the vihara abiding is not the absorption of a jhanic state.
They're basically synonymous.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. The jhana is this technical term for meditative absorption, and the Brahma Vihara are the places one, or the objects one gets absorbed into, or the realms one abides in, as it were.
I just kind of feel like that that resting place seems to me more like the pause in between the identities. And mm-hmm. the identity then has the suffering.
The moving around.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. yeah, that sort of vihara, home, and the resting
right.
doesn't seem like the birth part, but in between.
Cool. I can totally go with that, actually.
Yay.
So there's a way that I could there's a way that I could imagine it both ways. And maybe this is, maybe different folks' life stories are more like this. Like, maybe one person's life is like lots of confusion and then a chunk of stability that they identify with. And then, and that's, and like, for them, the stopping places are more the identity that you took birth into. Maybe for someone else, it's like long, stable periods that are kind of not satisfying in a certain way, and then the wandering has this kind of like seeking and dynamicness and like creativity and flowering of identity in it, and then there's a kind of stuckness.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think of them as two phases in a process, you know, they could have different relationships, right, in different for different folks. So I could see for one person the moving around has a more identity quality. For another person, the kind of stable chunk has the identity quality. I like that.
About in relation to what you were saying about how this piece is not developmentally appropriate for all.
Yeah.
Do you think the implication is that no one can achieve liberation until we've achieved a perfected, socially just society on Earth?
No, because if that were the case, then no one ever would have achieved liberation, because there's never been that society.
Yeah.
You know, the Buddha's society was violent and unequal and chaotic, and
yeah.
kings were killing other kings, and you know, he tried to intervene in wars, and it was a mess. So that can't be the result. But I do think that, especially in the earliest layer of the teachings, there is the sense that you have to find some separation from that social chaos and the feeling of safety and stability in order to go all the way to liberation. And so in the early system, you get a very clear differentiation between the monastics who leave the cities, who leave the social drama, who leave politics, who leave money and relationship, and they go out and they live communally in the forest, owning nothing, basically pure communists. And in that state of not needing to own property or use money or build families or have any kind of politics, then they can take those final steps toward liberation. So partly, yes, but you can't rely on the entire system becoming perfect, because it'll never happen. What you can do is you can create islands of clarity, which now we could almost just call like an affinity group. Like, you get together with your people, and within that group, you can heal something profound, right? Like, you could all become better allies to oppression. And you can't solve Oakland, but you can solve your group of 20 people somewhat. And then to the degree that you could do that with your 20 people or your 100 people or whoever, you'll have a greater chance of resting into these profound states within that contained setting. So there's very much the sense in the early system that some amount of solitude or separation from the chaos is necessary, since the chaos can never be defeated on its own terms.
Do you think that actively working for social justice and seeking liberation are fundamentally incompatible?
The correct answer is no.
The actual answer
is that I don't know what fundamentally means. I think that doing liberation work internally and liberation work externally can coexist for a very, very, very long time on the path. Maybe almost forever. And so almost all of the serious practitioners that I know of are concerned with social action in some way. But in both threads, there's a heightened way of being that's sort of the extreme end of things that's incompatible with the extreme end of the other. So like in terms of social action, it's possible to connect with an issue so fully that you can't drop it for a month because you're so tight into the micro changes and you're steering something. It's impossible to go on retreat when you do that. It's also impossible to let go fully because you're doing the opposite of letting go. You're actually steering something through the culture. So if you're doing that, it's not the right time in your life to renounce. And so then you can't actually do this kind of liberation work, like letting go of all your fixed views, because you're working on something, and it wouldn't be appropriate to do so. Likewise, to do this practice of like absolute emptying out, I really only see people land in those mind states of like profound non-thought, universal love, body dissolved into the universe states on deep retreat. So that's like, okay, you got to have at least a couple months off to do that. And so in a literal way, moment to moment, there are states in each of those columns that are incompatible with each other. But, and a few people in every culture, I think, appropriately choose one of those things essentially to give their entire life's energy to. So like there's people who give their entirety to social action and almost in a way sacrifice a part of their inner life on the altar of the whole, the culture. And then there's other folks who and I think likewise for the sake of the whole thing, give the entirety of their being to individual practice. These are the monastics who will just like, you know, 30 years in a cave or just like entire lifetime stabilizing the monastic community. And that's their action, you know. And there's not that many of those folks. I don't think that they detract from social action as a whole any more than a few blown-out activists detract from the inward life of most people. So, I don't think that they're fundamentally incompatible, and most of our lives weave between the two. But that at their most refined points, there are states that are incompatible between them. Yeah.
Thank you.
For sure. It's a good question. All right. So we'll close for the night. We'll close with the dedication and sharing of merit chants at the end of the chant sheet. So very often these chants are done to close a period of practice. They have the wish of loving kindness, may all beings be happy, free from ill will, animosity. And then the offering of merit, whatever merit is generated by this practice, may it be shared by all beings. And then there's this beautiful blessing, may the devas or the earth spirits protect you, and by the power of the triple gem, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, may you forever be well. So I'll chant this one in Pali. A few of you know it. You chant along. Sabbe Sata Sada Hontu. Sabbe Sata Sada Hontu Avera Sukha Jivino Katam Punya Palam Maiham Sabbe Bhagi Bhavantute Hotu sabangsu mangalam rakantu sabha devata sabha buddhanubhavena soti hontu nirantaram. Hotu sabangsu mangalam rakantu sabha devata sabha dhammanubhavena soti hontu nirantaram. Hotu sabangsu mangalam rakantu sabha devata. Sabba sangha nubhavena soti hontu nirantaram. May the blessings and merit of our practice and of engagement with this text these months be an offering to all beings everywhere. May all beings know happiness and the causes of happiness, safety and the causes of safety. May all beings rest in the conditions most conducive to liberation and well-being. May all oppression and violence end. May the hearts find ease and peace. May all who long for liberation find what they seek. All right. Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure. I'll see you next week. We'll start in on something new.
Thank you.